From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on January 23rd when 14 members of the New York State Assembly introduced a bill that would essentially allow physician-assisted death for the terminally ill. Assembly member Amy Pollan said, quote, "If I am terminally ill, I should be able to choose to end my life calmly, peacefully, and in a dignified way, at a time and in a setting I choose where I am surrounded by those I love," end quote. But the bill has not found enough support to pass. Now go back to November of 2014. 29-year-old Brittany Maynard had been diagnosed with brain cancer earlier that year, and she made national headlines by announcing her intention to die with the aid of her physician, instead of allowing the cancer to slowly and painfully kill her. She moved to Oregon, which passed a Death with Dignity bill in 1997. Maynard ended her life on November 1st of 2014, and just a few months later, Time magazine chronicled the states that seemed ready to learn from her story and pass right-to-die legislation of their own. Now, it has largely not happened. It has happened in some states, but as New York State shows as an example, not most. The Rochester Academy of Medicine is getting ready to host 4 sessions related to the end of life and everything we can do to make that process better for everyone. This hour, we're going to preview those sessions, and we'll talk about where our country goes next when it comes to how we die. My guests this hour include Dr. Jeff Mahovsky, who is the chair of the program committee for retired physicians at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. Dr. Mahovsky, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Evan.
And trust me when I tell you, that board is all set. So all you got to do is be right next to the microphone. Thanks for being here, Dr. Mahovsky. Dr. Tim Quill is back in the program. He's a professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Quill, welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Dr. Quill, I remember around the death of Brittany Maynard, and I frankly was surprised to find out we're coming up on 3 years since then. But I remember having a conversation with you about a number of these issues. And just that speculation that this national case was so different than, you know, for years we heard the Dr. Kevorkian stories and characterized fairly or unfairly, depending on many's position on this. But Brittany Maynard's story seemed to be making a public dent in a way that a lot of other stories had not. And there was the speculation in places like Time magazine and others that this was going to be the change agent. Well, it hasn't happened in New York State, but before the hour began, both of you were saying, well, it hasn't happened here, but you have seen it in a number of states?
There's been a tremendous amount of change in political terms, such that now 6 states and the District of Columbia have legalized physician aid in dying. All of Canada has now legalized both physician aid in dying and voluntary act of euthanasia. So these are big changes in political terms. New York State is not going to be one of those states on the cutting edge because in New York, these changes are dependent on the legislative process, and the legislative process in this domain is very difficult. It's pretty easy to demagogue this issue.
To demagogue it?
Yeah, to overstate different parts, to say, I really don't want to deal with it, or to just say, this is not something we should get into at all. The states that have passed this have had, by and large, referendums where the people speak. And New York State's a very difficult state for referenda.
Okay, and maybe in demagoguing, I recall the amount of commentaries you hear about Kevorkian was a murderer, those kinds of things, as opposed to just trying to understand case by case who is going to doctors for this kind of help and in those settings. And let me ask both the doctors in this room, don't surveys show that the vast majority of people say, when asked, how do you want to die? I want to die at home, surrounded by family and friends, as comfortable as I can be. And yet so often, when we have terminal illness, we die in a hospital setting hooked up to machines. And it is not how we envision. Is that fair? Dr. Quill, Dr. Mahovsky, you agree with that?
I can start, but it's fair. We do have hospice care set up at home, and hospice is the way most people want to be cared for at the end of their lives. But hospice care at home requires a tremendous amount of caring by family members. Hospice care, the professional care is anywhere from 0 to 2 to 4 hours a day. So it really means that families have to step up. And people are very sick by the time they get to this point. So there's a lot of caring involved in this, and not everybody can do it.
Okay. Dr. Mahovsky?
Yeah, it's been my experience, too, that hospice care takes a lot of preparation. It's not something you set up in 24 hours. And patients have to be guided in the anticipation of what the needs, the future needs of their loved ones are. for themselves as well as for their loved ones, so that, that there can be that mental preparation, that emotional preparation to make a commitment to that we're going to do this. But they have to have realistic expectations about the need for their own participation and how willing they are or prepared they are to provide those services for their loved ones in conjunction with the auxiliary care that's offered by the hospice program.
How do both of you feel about the term physician-assisted suicide? Is that a pejorative or is that an accurate term? I ask out of ignorance.
The use of the word suicide in this doesn't really fit in my mind because it conflates this process with mental illness and people doing things that are self-destructive. The people who are interested in this option really view this option as a way to preserve what remains of themselves. So it's really a self-preservation. So again, those who are in favor of this option would prefer to use language like physician aid in dying, physician-assisted death.
Okay, got it. And when it comes to the polling, I think it's a little different state to state, but California, for example, had a 2/3 support. Those are strong numbers. Do both of you expect that the public at large is in favor of this kind of legislation? Tim?
Yeah, I would say the public, the majority of the public, usually it turns out to be about 70% are in favor. When you start getting down to the specifics of who should do it and what do you call it, some of that support is soft. So it goes around 50-50, maybe a little bit more in favor. But that's why when you get down to referenda, it can be a pretty close vote, which it has been in places where it's been tested that way.
And yet, Dr. Mahovsky, we see states slow to adopt medical marijuana when there is overwhelming public support for it. We see states slow to adopt things like death with dignity bills when there is strong support, or at least a pretty clear majority support. Can't really always count on the legislature to do the hard lifting if you don't have referenda, yes?
I agree that I think, again, that the people that hold the legislative power in any organization feel that their job is to direct the well-being of those under their care or their constituency to protect them from unknowns. And in doing that, I think they discredit the public in many instances in appreciating that they can make their own decisions in certain things. We see this in all kinds of organizations where the guiding powers decide that this is what we'll do and pretty much lay it out for the public or the people under them.
In a moment, we'll talk about the four sessions coming up through the Rochester Academy of Medicine and how you can get involved September 14th, 21st, 28th, and October 5th with the following themes: Dying in America, a Roadmap for Improving Quality and Honoring Preferences for Care. On Nursing Home and Hospice Care is the second session. The third session, Spiritual Life at the End of Life. And the final session, The Promise of Palliative Care and the Possibility of a Physician-Assisted Death as a Last Resort. That's presented by Dr. Quill, and that's on October 5th. We're going to get to those in just a second. But listeners, again, if you missed the name of the bill, if you're just curious, in New York State, the latest iteration of a Death with Dignity bill is Assembly Bill 2383, Medical Aid in Dying Act. And Representative or Assembly Member Amy Paulin from Scarsdale, together with 10 co-sponsors and 4 multi-sponsors, put that forward. So hasn't gone anywhere in New York State, and you heard off the top from our guests why they don't expect it to go anywhere. But Dr. Quill, let's work backwards through the sessions then, because you're the final session, and you're talking about the possibility of a physician-assisted death as a last resort. Does the law allow for any kind of setting or circumstance in this state that does allow for physician-assisted death?
Well, yeah, let me just reframe just for a moment to say that palliative care and hospice are really the standards of care for people who are very sick and approaching the end of life. We really have very good measures to address most suffering, most pain, support families and patients. So physician-assisted death or other last resort options are only for those relatively infrequent cases where suffering is very difficult despite our efforts to relieve them. Now, there are options that are not physician-assisted death that are currently legally available. For example, if you're on any kind of life-sustaining therapy, you can stop that as long as you're sure that you know the consequences of stopping it. If the issue is severe pain, we can give you as much pain medicine as you need, even in doses that might shorten your life. It's not our intent, but if it takes that to relieve your pain, we can do that. If you're on life supports, those can be stopped. People can be sedated, actually, if they are really suffering in very extreme ways at the very end of life, and that's permitted. So all those things are currently legally permitted, and the physician-assisted death would just be one other option that puts more of that control in the hands of patients.
I want to take a call from a listener who has a question on the administration of pain medications, opioids, et cetera. This is Bruce in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Bruce.
My question or the comment is, right now with the opioid epidemic we have of prescribed opioids out there, with doctors' willingness to do that, how do we vet the people that are going to say, okay, this person of sound mind and can make this decision or not, knowing that doctors are just people too and subject to influences and money, you know, other constraints. I'm sure that the payment would have to be there for someone to go and do this. So I just am very cautious about who can say, yeah, okay, you're of sound mind or not.
Well, we are used to making very hard decisions with seriously ill patients. Taking people off of life supports would probably be the example that we have the most experience with. When this discussion was being had 30 years ago, should we allow people to stop life supports? They're our most expensive patients, and a lot of the same arguments were made. And in point of fact, the way we protect against that is with an open process, with second opinions from people from palliative care and psychiatry, so that we get our best minds together if we're going to do any of these kind of toward-the-edge issues. Now, with regard to pain medicine, it's pain medicine toward the end of life, again, I think is still pretty secure and safe. I think where we have this controversy right now is when you move that way upstream and using opioids with people with serious chronic pain, and that's an area where we're having lots of discussion.
I wasn't making any correlation about pain medicine to them. I'm talking about everyday people and how easy it is for them to get a doctor to give them a prescription for those, not pain medicine in regards to people who are in palliative care or anything. Mm. I was just correlating it to the other piece, not how they're administered for palliative care.
Sure, sure.
I want to say that on the record, I'm for this. As long as it's administrated properly, people should have the right to decide for themselves. And often, even if they aren't given the right by the state, like Robin Williams, they take it themselves. But unfortunately, I thought he had so much more to give us before he made his choice. I just wish he had talked to somebody.
Well, Bruce, thanks for the phone call. Yeah, very big difference, Dr. Quayle, between opioid prescription when someone isn't in an end-of-life situation and opioids in palliative care, end-of-life.
Very different situation. And again, I think this is an area where we're all learning right now, because I think we underestimated the problems with addiction and dependence over with people with serious illness and pain. So I think we're learning more about that. We're learning about alternatives to opioids, and this is a whole nother discussion, I think. But at the end of life, at the very end of life, we don't have a lot of restraints around relieving pain, and we're willing to give whatever it takes to do that, because to not do it doesn't make any sense in that circumstance.
Now, if New York State ever did have a kind of death with dignity law, and by the way, maybe if there's a state constitutional convention, this is the kind of thing that is just one of the many components that could come up. Who knows if we will see something like that. But just as an example, the California bill would require two independent physicians to determine that patients are mentally competent to make an end-of-life decision, and that's pretty similar to Oregon's 1997 law. And I imagine, Dr. Quayle, that would probably be the kind of standard. Is that the kind of standard we're seeing in other states, that two independent physicians deem that this patient can make, is of sound mind to make that kind of a decision? And is that a good standard to have?
It's a good standard. There's some waiting periods involved between the request and the time that the medicine is made available. Patients have to take finally the medicine by their own hand again. So this is another safeguard built in. They have to be terminally ill, as determined by those two. So they both have to be competent and terminally ill by those two physicians' assessment, and if there's any question of mental illness being seen by a psychiatrist.
And when it comes to how often people in Oregon, for example, that have had this bill for 20 years now, the latest data we have is from 2014, and according to the Oregon Public Health Division, 1,173 people have had end-of-life medication prescribed to them. 752 have actually chosen to ingest it. That's by 2014, so those numbers will be a little bit higher now. But the point is, we're talking about doing a little math. You know, boy, am I bad at math?
It's about 1 in 300 that actually take it.
1 in 300 that actually.
But one in 50 talk to their doctors about it.
Okay.
1 in 6 talk to their families about it. So there is a lot of conversation about these issues, but in an open system, very rarely does it get actuated.
Isn't that interesting? That even with the option, not very many people are using it.
Most people are fearful about the future, and they want to know that there could be an escape if they get to that point. The notion that you could have an escape is very reassuring to people who are used to having a lot of choices in their life, but they actually, very few, ultimately need it in an open system.
Okay, and I do not at all want to reduce death and dying to numbers and just cost and money, but I do want to ask honestly, when we look at the cost that the average person has in their lifetime for medical bills, doesn't the bulk of it tend to come toward the end in the last stages of our life? Yes? Is that correct?
That is correct. Probably, I think they talk about the 80-20 rule and such that 80% of Medicare costs take care of the 20% in the last year of their life. And that's maybe an overgeneralization, but it kind of focuses you on the fact that the majority of funds that are spent by Medicare are in the last year of life for those people that they're in that program.
And so even for people who would see the Brittany Maynard story or think more seriously at length about this issue or think about their own family and watching your own family members have to deal with illnesses that we all have had to endure, even if the answer would be that a death with dignity bill would relate to higher cost, I think a significant portion of people would say that's okay, that dignity option has to be there. But the reality is, and again, not just to reduce this to a money thing, but it would seem that with these laws, even if not all that many people are using them, that would still have some downward impact on the total cost of healthcare in this country. Is that possible?
I think the effect on the total cost of healthcare is going to be minuscule. It's going
minimal?
To be very minimal because the numbers are so small.
It, yeah.
And the people who are using this have also been in care for a long time. They've taken a lot of treatment. This is not something that people choose when they're first diagnosed.
Right, when they're diagnosed, yeah. So
I don't think, okay. I think the cost effects one way or the other are going to be minuscule.
But they certainly would seem not to raise costs. Go ahead, Doctor.
Well, the broader question or picture is that most people, as they enter the final stages of life, even if they're not terminally ill, tend to be potential victims of the system, the health system, because they get into with chronic heart failure and cancers and such that they do what they're told because not enough people, not enough providers have taken the time to help guide them and have those long discussions that are in depth about this is what you can expect and this is how you can prepare and these are your options early on and then to revisit those as they progress through these stages of life. And so the system generates those costs and people have a living will and they express the desire that they do not want to have cardiac resuscitation or pulmonary intubation or anything, then they faint at home. The ambulance is called. They're taken into the emergency room, and they're unconscious. And what happens? They're intubated, and they're resuscitated because the system doesn't have access to the records immediately, and the wishes aren't met. But then they're in the ICU. The thousands of dollars are rolling up while the family all gathers together. They discuss things that hopefully had been discussed before, but now a lot of issues with families, within families, and the relationships, and all of the children if there are multiple children or multiple interests in the welfare of that individual, have to agree in a very compressed period of time. And it really makes it extremely difficult for the families emotionally, psychologically, and for the providers that are trying to minister to the needs of the patient in the most effective and compassionate way.
I know I mentioned it several years ago when we talked about Brittany Maynard's story, but one of my favorite Radiolab podcast episodes is on how physicians die differently. Why do doctors die differently? And Dr. Mahovsky, I imagine doctors die, when you say doctors die differently, generally speaking, in the macro, doctors will want CPR less often. Doctors will want sort of, life extension measures. If quality of life is going to be low, they won't want that. Whereas the general population, if you haven't had those conversations, will you say, well, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of in that moment. And I don't blame people. I mean, I think we've all sort of been there and are desperate for that, that whatever can be done. But is it fair? Do you think that general statement, doctors tend to die differently, is fair?
Well, I think doctors have an insider information or knowledge of what happens in all of these processes. And even with their families, and that's why physicians probably get better care too, because they're more knowledgeable about the system and how to navigate the system. How do we inform and educate the public about being better consumers of healthcare?
Okay. Dr. Quill?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I do think the whole movement toward having people do more healthcare proxies in living wills is to try to have patients and their family members have some of these conversations about what are the boundaries for what they're willing to have with treatment. Do they want absolutely everything no matter what? Or are there circumstances when they would want things to be stopped? It is incredibly reassuring if you're talking about stopping treatment or shifting over to hospice for somebody who can't speak for themselves. If you've had a conversation with them in the past where you know what they would want and you know you're speaking with their voice, that is tremendously helpful. And have these conversations in advance is just a gift for your family. We should all be doing it.
Starting at what age?
Well, probably you should start the conversation at the age of 18 or 21, really, having the conversation in general. Now, again, it needs to be revisited over time, because what you want as a 21-year-old may not be the same as what you want as a 71-year-old or whatever. But I think having it be part of the conversation, having families sit down and talk about this as a group is very helpful. It sort of gets this out from under this forbidden topic zone so that people have talked about it before, and families can then face some of these hard decisions. The decisions will still be hard. But boy, if the voice of the patient who no longer can speak for themselves, if they've said things that guide you, it's tremendously helpful.
No, I'm not going to be getting myself in trouble. I'm gonna say this knowing that my mother and stepfather are not listening. They're in Ohio. But on the off chance they are, I hope they are, because they've both been through a lot physically. And I'd like to believe in immortality for them. And Mom and Don, you guys are going to be around as long as I hope that you want to be there. But they also are not very good at talking about what's difficult to think about. And I wonder, if I send an email to my family saying, hey, Mom, I'm a little younger than you, but here are my wishes. If anything ever happens to me, now you've got it. I'll be ready to grab yours when you want to send them to me. Is that a way to start it too, to say it's the kind of conversation we can have at any age?
That would be absolutely a great way. And also, by the way, you will likely be the one who's having to make that decision. So it's a tremendous...
If they don't.
If they can't make the decision, if they lose the ability. So you can frame this as they're making a gift to you by having this conversation with you. Because it is, having made these conversations for my own parents when they lost capacity, I knew what they wanted. So even though some of the decisions were very hard, and I had a brother who died young from an accident. And he, it was a horrible decision, but we'd had those conversations. I was his healthcare proxy. I knew what he wanted. So I didn't have to agonize with that part of it.
Listeners, in our second half hour, we're going to go through the four sessions coming up, and we're going to let you know on how you can get involved and what they're going to be talking about. September 14th, 21st, 28th, and October 5th. We'll tell you about everything that they've got coming your way. Before I go to break and we shift into that, I do want to grab a phone call, and it comes from Bob in Rochester, who knows Dr. Quill. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi. My wife was struck with terminal cancer a number of years ago, and we in Rochester are really fortunate to have Dr. Quill and his palliative care hospice team with us. They recommended that we be in touch with palliative care to develop a relationship as soon as possible, which we did, and we met with our doctor a good almost 15 months before my wife passed away. And that allowed us to develop a real relationship with her. My wife and her sort of really bonded. And then over the course of the next many months, as things took their inevitable path, that relationship deepened. And when it came time to be told that it was really, you know, further treatments were not really useful, we talked about home hospice care, and we were prepared for it. And, you know, the next several months were wonderful to be able to be at home. So I'm sorry.
It's okay.
To be able to be at home and be surrounded by family and loved ones. And that relationship with the doctors for that long of a period of time made the entire process just so much more graceful, I guess. So I just wanted to say that. I think we're incredibly fortunate to have a team as wonderful as the team that's headed by Dr. Quill and of course, the rest of the folks involved as well. So thank you.
So thank you so much calling. And you know, what you're describing is the way the system has the possibility of working. So if we can get involved with palliative care early on when somebody's sick, they may well recover. They may well live for many, many, many years. So it's not about terminal illness at that point. It's about making the quality of life as good as it can be for as long as it can be. And it's making sure you get the best possible treatment given your circumstance. Then if you have to make the transition to hospice, which is a very challenging transition, you're making that transition with people you know and trust. And your experience is consistent with mine and many others. The transition to hospice, even though it's a hard mountain to climb, people are very glad they've made it, because then quality of life is everything and they really maximize that. And you have a team to help you out through the last phase. So that is the way the system's supposed to work. And I thank you for calling and giving testimony to that, because we have a system that works most of the time for most people, actually.
I don't think you've ever been on this program and you haven't had someone call to tell you something like that, Dr. Quill. Does that still impact you in a personal way?
Sure it does. Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm still working at this old age that I am, because I find the work incredibly rich and meaningful. I enjoy working with people through these kind of very tough paths that they're often going through. And we can really try to make the system really work for them. And it's very gratifying.
Listeners, if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You heard our guests earlier this hour say that despite the fact that six states now have essentially death with dignity permission law, Oregon the first going back to 1997, New York State unlikely to have one, given the fact that we don't really often see a referendum that's unlikely to go up to voters. Now, if it went up to a public vote, there's a good chance it would pass, but it would have to go through the legislature for the most part now. New York State does have a bill, and they've had a number of bills over the years, but the bills haven't gone very far. And so that's the case in New York State right now. The current bill in the Assembly is called the Medical Aid in Dying Act, and there is a similar bill in the Senate, but the bill has not really gone anywhere. Our guests are talking about these issues because the Rochester Academy of Medicine is putting on an end-of-life forum for the community, four separate sessions, starting on September 14th. We'll tell you all about how you can get involved with that when we come back with Dr. Tim Quill, Professor of Medicine, Psychiatry, and Medical Humanities at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and Dr. Jeff Mahovsky, who is the chair of the program committee for retired physicians at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. We are right back. Coming up in our second hour, it's the Summer of Food on Connections. Our final conversation in the Summer of Food series goes to El Pilon in Rochester, not only for its outstanding food, but the remarkable backstory that led a woman to start a food stand at the Puerto Rican Festival in 1992 on her way to becoming the Rochester Hispanic Business Person of the Year in 2015. The story next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Audrey on Twitter says, Dr. Quill helped my mother during her last month of life. He gave her medicine that helped her cope with her pain, and he was wonderful. On the phone, Jill in Rochester is calling. You're a nurse, Jill?
Yeah, I'm a nurse in a local area hospital, and I think that a medical aid in dying act would get my full support. So often in times and in times of long-term illness or terminal illness, I see patients come through, and I feel like as a nurse, I'm not really helping them. I'm just putting off death for another day. And I feel like, you know, we're always told, you know, you can't, the only things in life you can't prevent are death and taxes. And in death, we have no control. And I feel like more patients would get comfort from knowing they had a choice. And especially in a setting, in a hospital setting, surgeons love to operate. Critical care doctors love to apply therapies. But to what end? How are we helping this person? Are we just putting off death for hours? Or are we putting them through a painful procedure to get maybe a day or two more? And I feel like patients would benefit so much more from having choices earlier on in the disease process. And in my own family, I've lost everyone. And I can't say enough about hospice and palliative care, but I feel like in a lot of ways we're just sitting and waiting for death to happen. And that makes the process that much harder. And I feel like if somebody had the choice to pull their own plug, so to speak, that they would feel more like they were living rather than that they were dying. And I just feel like people might choose differently if they felt that they had more control and it came from a compassionate source with a physician's knowledge and how to help them navigate the process, rather than waiting until the very end when emotions are high and, you know, we've got maybe 2 weeks to live. Yeah, That's not the time to make these decisions and make these choices. I feel like it needs to happen much earlier. It's easier to talk with your family about these choices when they feel like it's not right now. It's not right in their face. So I think as a nurse, this a medical aid in dying act would get my full support.
Well, Jill, thank you for the phone call. Interesting, she says, without that, patients don't often feel as much control as they might otherwise, even if they wouldn't choose that, but they don't have the option. And she says that they feel more like they are living if they would have that choice, as opposed to just sort of succumbing to a long and painful, slow process of dying. Dr. Quill, what do you make of that?
Well, I think it speaks to the fact that one in six seriously ill people would like to talk with their families about this, or do talk to their families about it. One in 50 talk to their doctors, but it only accounts for one in 300 deaths. There's tremendous reassurance to know that there could be an escape. And sometimes even in New York, the conversation that, you know, if suffering gets really bad, we can provide sedation or we can stop treatment. These things may be very reassuring to people who actually don't activate it right away, but they don't feel trapped anymore. The whole notion of feeling trapped is a very big issue. And once you don't feel trapped, you can sometimes live with things that you never thought you could live with. Whereas if you say, well, there's no choices, then every day you're kind of wondering, oh my God, you know, what if? And if you have some answers to that, that can be very helpful.
And let's see here. We've got Mike in Rochester who wants to talk about the conversations that need to be had with patients. Go ahead, Mike.
I actually work in a practice that we visit folks in their homes. Large portion of geriatrics, yet I'm always amazed at the number of times discussion has not been had with patients or families about what ifs. And I never leave my first visit with these folks without seeing a scenario. Tell me, what are your wishes should have forbid you develop a terminal illness? And it's very interesting that the first reaction you get from family members is they're kind of aghast you've asked this question. Yet the patient will sit there and be very composed and speak about it. But once that discussion has been had, it's almost like this huge burden has been lifted off of families' shoulders, and that finally, you know, we actually do know. But it's just off nostalgia, and I don't think there's many physicians that will actually sit down and have this conversation with patients either. Whether it's a time factor, I'm not sure how to explain it. But the conversation, I think, that needs to be had with all patients.
Mike, thank you. Dr. Quill, I'm a little surprised to hear that the physician, he thinks physicians aren't having that conversation often. I certainly understand family not having the conversation.
I think physicians aren't having it. These are complicated conversations, but it doesn't necessarily have to be had by physicians. So within this community, take, for example, when somebody's admitted to a nursing home for the first time. Some of our better nursing homes, every patient who comes in anew, there's a sit down with the patient and family within the first week that they come in, and they talk about moles, they talk about what things they would and what would want and wouldn't want, they talk about advanced care planning, they just make it routine. And those nursing homes tend to have a lot less back and forth to the hospital, they tend to patients feel empowered. There are other nursing facilities that don't have that, and they statistically have tremendous amount more back and forth to the hospital. Every time somebody gets a little sick, people are panicked because they haven't had that discussion. So these discussions really should be part of the routine for every really sick patient.
Dr. Mahovsky, I saw you nodding there just briefly when Tim said, you know, they're tough conversations for everybody.
And they are, and they're not a 15-minute conversation. Once you start open that topic up, there are so many layers to it and anxieties within the individual patients. That and physicians in the current payment system are reimbursed for turning patients over, so that each patient that they see, they receive a fee for. Well, the fee that you get, whether you're talking about death and dying, is the same fee you get for taking care of a cold. And it's a much more prolonged period of time that's required to do it justice, both from the provider's standpoint and from the patient's standpoint. And physicians have their overhead. They have all the regulatory issues they have to meet. They have all the employees that they have to pay. And they have to generate some income. So if they're seeing one patient for 1 hour and they're paid the same as they were if they were seeing one patient for 15 minutes, obviously, that plan can't sustain itself. So we have to change payment reforms, and we have to change physicians' and patients' expectations about what does care really mean to talk about care and quality of care. And there's this whole movement towards pay-for-performance or outcomes rather than just processing patients through a procedure or a visit. And getting them out the door within 15 minutes so we can see the next patient. The other problem is that there is a dearth of qualified providers to have these conversations, and there's a shrinking number of primary care physicians in this country. It's a very complex problem that has multiple layers that you can't say, well, fix this one thing and then everything will be fine. But it has to be. There has to be a major change on the part of the payers and on the part of the physicians too.
Why don't both of you write healthcare reform in this country?
Just a point of clarification. There has been a little. There's a code now for advanced care planning. So actually, if you do advanced care planning, you can bill for that on top of whatever else you're doing. But there are logistical issues that are very problematic. You know, how do you maybe they don't want to have the conversation when I've scheduled them for a half an hour to do that or those kinds of things. But it is possible to get paid. But I think the more difficult problem is the logistics of how do we do it? Who should be doing it? And I do think we should be empowering people who aren't doctors, people like the caller who came in who are doing home visits. Boy, if they want to know where that conversation, if that person were trained and skilled and wanted to do it, that would be the ideal spot to do it.
Every phone line is filled up. We're going to take as many calls as we can before the end of the hour, but let me do this. I want to ask Dr. Mahovsky. So if you're on the phone, Chris, Lila, Judith, we're coming to you. But Dr. Mahovsky, I just want you to tell the community how they can get involved in the four sessions coming up through the Rochester Academy of Medicine. It's the end-of-life forum for the community under the following heading: September 14th, Dying in America, a roadmap for improving quality and honoring preferences for care. September 21st, on nursing home and hospice care. September 28th, spiritual life at the end of life. And October 5th, the promise of palliative care and the possibility of a physician-assisted death as a last resort. Those four sessions, what are the costs, how to get involved, how to register?
Yeah, the costs are $5 per session and $15 if you sign up for, or subscribe to the whole series. We're taking advanced purchases or subscriptions on our website at rochesteracademyofmedicine.org, and you can just Google Rochester Academy of Medicine, and it'll take you to the website. There is a specific page there on the website to register for these sessions or the series in total. The whole idea of these sessions is to prepare the community to have these conversations better at home and to also inform them how they can initiate these conversations with their treating physicians or providers that they normally access.
All right, the 14th, 21st, 28th, and October 5th, those four sessions coming up. Chris in Rochester wants to talk about the Hippocratic Oath. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi, Evan and Dr. Quill. Please, I just want to say, first of all, thank you very much for having this very important conversation. I am a neurologist in the area who's actually interested and tried to be an advocate for palliative care for each of my patients. I do my best to have early conversations with my patients about advanced care planning and try to talk about dignified death with them. And in thinking about a Medical Aid in Dying Act, one of the things that I've always really struggled with is our first role as physicians, which is to do no harm. And although I have this real desire to give my patients an option as an out, an option to end their life if they've really gotten to that point, as a physician, I don't personally feel comfortable with providing that myself. And so I just wanted to understand how you kind of come to terms with that oath that we take and this desire to, provide patients with the best and highest quality care that we can.
Thank you, Chris.
So I'm in total agreement that our real job is to relieve suffering, to give people the best care possible at the end of life. But we also have learned how to extend the dying process, and that people get into very tough situations along the dying process. So we've gotten comfortable with stopping life supports, for example, even when we know someone will die. And again, that is a part of participating in their death. We provide sedation at the very end of life, even though we know someone will die. And some of the patients will have the audacity to say they're ready now to die. And we have to learn how to listen to them and to try to be as responsible as responsive as we can. So I think the Hippocratic Oath says a lot of things also that we no longer believe in. Again, I generally believe in the Hippocratic Oath, but there are parts, only men should be doctors, and what do we do when we're caring for people that we're really committed to when they are dying and we've been caring with them and they're dying badly? I think we have an obligation to be responsive. If you can't do, and you may be in the position where this is not acceptable to you as an individual, what options can you provide them? I think that's the challenge you have, and you probably have come up with, well, I can take them off life supports, I could provide sedation. And I think all those things are very important. So I think we have to figure out how we can respond. And in New York, we have to figure out where it's illegal. How can we respond and be within the law? And I think that's why we've come up with some of these other options.
Judith in Irondequoit next up. Go ahead, Judith.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to call and speak. I'm concerned in listening to this discussion that there's been no comment at all about the many, many people who oppose death with dignity, the supposed title that it's been given. Actually, the American Medical Association, as I understand it, opposes it, as do many organizations who work with disabled people, who advocate with elderly people. I'm wondering why none of these voices is being heard in this conversation, or these points are being made. One of the reasons that it's not becoming legal in New York State is that there is such strong opposition to it. And I think it's important that those voices be heard in this conversation.
Judith, do you think...
Thank you for allowing me to just...
Sure, sure, yeah.
Statement. I have worked with people who are dying. I've been a home nursing assistant and a pastoral assistant and have been with people as they have died. I've never seen anyone who didn't die with dignity. Dignity is part of the human person. And so this is a very profound conversation. It needs to be explored in all of its aspects and all of the voices involved in this conversation need to be heard. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Can you stay on the line, Judith?
Yes.
Stay on the line, but thanks for the phone call. I'll let Dr. Quill start with that. I know you've heard a lot of those kind of comments. Go ahead, Dr. Quill.
No, I appreciate your calling, actually. No one listening to this should believe that there is a deep consensus. I think this is an area where there are serious differences of opinion by really well-intended, very moral people on both sides. And I think this is a work in progress in the United States. And in the rest of the developed world, we're just trying to figure out how to be responsive to patients in very tough circumstances. And we may, you know, the pendulum may go back in the other direction, in which case we have to then try to figure out how can we respond to these tough cases in other ways. So I appreciate your calling because I think it puts some sobriety in our conversation, which I think should be there. This is a big deal, and people who are really thoughtful and really do a lot of good work in this area disagree deeply about this question.
Dr. Quill, she said you said earlier you're concerned when people die badly, and Judith is saying she's never seen someone die without dignity. How do you square those?
Well, I mean there are a lot of data about a small number of cases of people dying in ways that they personally find unacceptable. Now, is that bad or not? If they really find it very unacceptable, to me, that would be bad, because the person who's dying's values count more than mine or hers or yours. Having said that, we may not be able to respond to all those cases. Most of the time, with hospice care, people can die quite acceptably, sometimes quite beautifully. So we're really talking about a small number of cases where dying gets very tough, and how do we respond to those cases? And again, my view has always been we have to really stretch ourselves to respond without violating fundamental values. So again, each of those might be individual values, they might be society values that we're all struggling with right
sure.
now.
And Judith, I would just say in my own family, I mean, I've seen members die in which they were essentially unrecognizable mentally for well over a year, if not several years, that they lost physical control of their bodily functions, that other family members in caring for them ended up with back injuries and serious problems and pain just because they were kept alive through any means necessary and not allowed to have a choice about it. And I would say that in that way, that's less dignity than they probably would have preferred if you had given them more of a framework of choices before they were deeply sick. Does that make sense, Judith?
Well, I suppose that this would invite a conversation on the meaning of dignity, wouldn't it? You know, if we're going to define dignity, how are we going to define dignity? The truth is that serious illness really puts us in very vulnerable positions. And the question that I see here on the table is how do we respond really to honor that dignity, which really is the person's life. I mean, you know, when we see a person in front of us, we all want to give them the best, most compassionate, supportive care that we can. And it troubles me to think that, you know, that we need to think that we have to have them die for that to happen.
Well, and I've got to go, Judith, just because we're out of time, but I want to say this. I'm really glad, and I know Dr. Quill expressed this, that you called. And sometimes we have a perfectly what people would call balanced panels with views on all kinds of sides. And sometimes we invite experts in a field who might hold opinions. Dr. Quill has his own ideas as well, respects others. But this is always an open forum. That's why we've got an open phone number and ways to communicate. And Judith, I'm glad you called. And we will continue to have these discussions and to pursue some of the things that you're talking about. So for all of those whose calls did not get through, let's come back and do this again soon. And I want to thank Dr. Jeff Mahovsky and Dr. Tim Quill, who are helping put together this forum. The Rochester Academy of Medicine, it's an end-of-life forum for the community. Four different sessions, September 14th, 21st, 28th, and the 5th. The website for the Rochester Academy of Medicine, Jeff?
RochesterAcademyofMedicine.org.
Thank you both for being here. Really appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Much more Connections coming up next.